You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
Welcome, everybody, to the 602 Club. I am your host, Matthew Rushing, and I'm really excited to be here to be talking a little Black Panther. I love that a few weeks ago we talked about Black Lightning on television, and now we are diving into Black Panther. And I'm also really excited to have a guy whose name is in the credits, and his name is none other than Nick Anastasio. Nick, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me again in the club.
Absolutely. You know, what was fun is, so obviously with the Marvel movies, you have to stay through the credits. So when we got to the section with ILM, I pointed out your name to some friends of ours that were with us. And I was like, I know that guy. And they're like, no way. So it was really, I was like a superhero for a second.
Thank you. That's really sweet. I had a friend who, my best friend, Martin is African-American, and he had a lot of friends, you know, who were going out in force to see the movie over the weekend, you know, which was really exciting to be, you know, part of that. You know, I felt really privileged. And so we were actually hanging out at a cafe waiting to go see it. And he had other friends who were going to see it before us at another part of town. So there was kind of, it was a little bit staggered, right? And so his friend is texting him because I know her as well. And she knew that I'd worked on the film. So she was asking him, I think their screening was just ending. So she was texting in the theater saying, where's Nick's credit? So I can see it and point it to people. And somehow she missed it. So she actually, she told me later, she basically went right back in the movie and saw the movie again. So she could see my credit, which was really, really sweet.
That's awesome, man. Well, I mean, I love being able to do that too, of course, when I watch the Clone Wars, and it's so fun. But I'm excited to dive into this one. Before we do that, just a couple of quick housekeeping things. You can find us on iTunes at itunes.com/trekfm. That's where all of our shows are. While you're over there on Apple Podcasts, give us a star rating and review. We say this every time, but it's totally true. It really does help more people find the show when they're looking for general geek shows. In fact, as Nick can attest, he found the show just because he was looking for podcasts, and that's how we became friends.
True story. So that's a fact.
Yeah. So, I love that, and I've had so many people that has happened because of being in the podcasting world. So, again, if you like the show, hit us up with a star rating review. We'll mention you on the show, too. You can find us on Twitter, Trek FM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We've got the listeners only discussion group, which so many different people from around the world are in that discussion group talking about the shows and things going on here on Trek FM, and that's the Babel Conference. Type Babel into the search field on Facebook, or if you're on our website at trek.fm, you can hit discussion on any of the menu bars, and that'll let you right in. And then, of course, if you'd like to send us an email, a great place to do that is over at trek.fm/contact. You choose a show, you choose the 602 Club, and then that email comes to me and any of the hosts that week, and so we'll be able to converse with you that way. But Nick, I wanted to ask you something. For me, I'm not a huge Marvel comic reader. I've slowly started to dip my toe into that, but it's hard. I mean, comics, it's so vast. But I wanted to know if you had a history at all with this character and the comics.
Yeah, I did, but only limited, indirect, I should say. I read a lot of Black Panther comics, but not his comic book titles as much. So I read a lot of stories that featured Black Panther, mostly in the Avengers, and sometimes with other groups. But I wasn't so familiar with his one-on-one one title. But again, you know, one of my best friends is a huge Black Panther fan. And so he filled me in on some of the background characters and kind of gave me an overview of who they were in the comic books and sort of the specifics. A lot of the characters who are featured in the film were more specific to his own title. So I knew Killmonger,
right?
And I knew Claw, but I didn't know some of the other characters who were featured in the comic book before.
Yeah, you know, for me, I have not read a lot of. I've read very small amounts of Black Panther, and that's because I just picked up the Coates run that he did. I have volumes 1 through 4, and I've read volumes 1 through 2. And so actually some of the things we actually see in the movie, there are a couple of lines actually that T'Challa uses in the comic that they actually use in the movie. So I thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. But I haven't gotten a chance to, unfortunately, read through any more yet. I've just had too much on my plate to dive in, but I enjoyed what I read. And so, you know, for me, it's always interesting because for the Marvel movies, I come in more of a novice. And so the only thing that the movie has to do is to capture me by itself, which is kind of fun because, you know, whereas something else like, you know, a DC film or a Star Wars movie or something like that, it's got expectations that it has to live up to. And, you know, these Marvel movies, for the most part, don't have that for me. So they actually have less to do to capture me, which is great. I actually enjoy that process sometimes. But I thought it would be kind of cool just to dive in because there's some really, and I have to say this right up front, I think that the hallmark and the strength of this movie is its characters. And it very much, I think, is this year's Wonder Woman. And I want to say that up front. I think it's wonderful that that is actually happening. You know, what Wonder Woman did for superhero films, I think Black Panther this year is doing for superhero films. And I think it shows that in the end, all we want are good stories with great characters. And in the end, what they look like is not as important. But it can be important to so many people around the world. And that's what's awesome is that this is blowing up. You know, so it's great to see that happening.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I come at it a little bit, you know, like I said, I think I'm probably a little more familiar with the character than you. I think I had the best of both worlds. I had enough familiarity through, I read a lot of Avengers when I was a kid, and he was in the Avengers a lot. And there were some basic broad strokes that I knew about the character through his stories. And you know what I've always loved about him is that in a little way like the Submariner or Doom, who are other Marvel characters, he's someone who comes at it not necessarily from the superhero standpoint or the villain standpoint. He's, as a king, someone who is always concerned with doing what's right for his people first. And if it so happens to fit into the agenda of the superhero's cause, whatever that is, then he's going to go along. And so I had that, and it was cool to see that definitely being implemented and respected. So I felt like there was some canonical, you know, but I had enough of a blank slate that I was really just coming into the movie, also largely like you, going in just for the experience, even having worked on it and knowing it. And it was really wonderful to be taken kind of by the tidal wave that you were describing, you know, the similar phenomenon as Wonder Woman. And I think it's fantastic. I mean, you know, I mentioned my best friend and, you know, the community around him and just to see the excitement, to feel any group of people, whatever walks of life, all of a sudden being, you know, feeling like there's something that really allows them to, like a flag, you know, flagpole, something that they can embrace and love. The energy, you know, around that is great. You know, there were people coming out of the theater when we were going in, who had already seen it twice. There was a whole family. It was really funny. There was a family coming out of the theater, 5 or 6 people, including 2 little old ladies.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they were so excited. And my buddy Martin stopped them, you know, and he was asking them, you know, what they thought of the movie. And they were just ecstatic. They were, I mean, these ladies must have been at least in their like mid late 70s, and they were giddy, like schoolgirls. And they said, oh, you know, we've already seen it three times. It's awesome, blah, blah, blah. I think it's great.
I'm right there with you. And I think part of the thing that I loved is that Civil War set up this character for me, and he was one of the standouts, I thought, of that film. And actually, it was that movie, even Civil War. I like Civil War. I think there's some issues with it. But the characterization and the storyline that we walked through with T'Challa in that was really strong, and it left me with a strong desire to actually see Black Panther. And so getting to spend more time with him, I thought was really fascinating. And I wanted to ask you this, Nick, because I thought it was interesting to have this on the heels of The Last Jedi. And he has a wonderful conversation with Nakia where she tells him, you know, he gets to decide what kind of king he wants to be. And he doesn't have to be tied to the mistakes of his ancestors. And he can choose to be different. And what I thought about that is that it really embodied to me the struggle of Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi in a lot of ways. And yet, in the end, I really felt like that T'Challa handles this, and that the thematic element of figuring out what to leave from the past in the past and what to bring forward with you into the future was done so much better here through the storyline we get with T'Challa's struggle of coming to grips with who his father was, what Wakanda has been in the past, and what it could be in the future.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's definitely one of the big, I would say, two central themes, in my opinion, of the film. And like you said, I think that those are archetypes, right? It's the story of life. It's the story of growing up. And those are very well, it's very well, very clearly delineated in the film. You know, I mean, it's almost like a Freudian archetype. You know, you learn from your father, and then you realize your father is flawed, and then you must symbolically kill your father so you can become your own man, right? It's part of the cycle of life. And I think that this is very well represented in the film in a way that is strong and deep, but also very accessible. It doesn't matter where you come at, you know, when you look at the film, it's not done in a way that preaches too much. The message is there, it's strong, and I think it'll stay with you whether you're 7 or 77, but it's very accessible. And I think as a kid, it's done in a way that'll reach you and you'll get it. And I think that translates, you know, the way that it's written, the way that it's acted. I must say that I think, like you said, one of the greatest strengths of the film is its cast. The actors who play the roles and the way that they acted, they believe the roles, but they also do it in they act the roles in a way that is just, I don't want to say cartoony because that somehow has kind of a negative connotation, but just stylized or a little aside from reality enough, that you feel like, again, it's more accessible towards younger viewers probably. And some of the visuals, I think, also help in a way. Those, you know, the scenes where T'Challa talks to his father in the spirit world,
yes,
the ancestor world, you know, they look very, and we worked on those scenes at ILM, and I'm not privy to direct communication with the director regarding this particular issue, but to me, it always felt like they looked. I mean, obviously, there's things about the lighting, you know, this kind of aura going on in the sky, which you wouldn't have really in Africa. But beyond that, just the saturation of the images and the kind of depth or lack thereof of the backgrounds, to me, is actually meant on purpose to tell you this is sort of a fables, a kid's storybook moment. And so rather than kind of have this hyper real African scene, it becomes really like what is. It's the words that really support the scene. And that makes it, I think, more impactful, especially towards kids.
It really, to me, those scenes where he visited the ethereal plane, it felt like the Panther King, the Lion King. You know, very much in line with that, especially that whole moment in The Lion King where he sees his father in the clouds, you know, and I really liked that. I thought that that was really interesting. And I thought Chadwick Boseman specifically in those scenes when he was dealing with his father, especially the second time he visits and he tells, you know, all of these ancestors, you were wrong. You know, I thought that was his acting there was so good, and it was such a strong scene because, you know, I thought that that was another thing that was really fascinating to watch him deal with. You know, he has to try to figure out what kind of king he wants to be, and he doesn't want to buck the ancestors because for them there's ancestor veneration. But at the same time, he realizes that them as kind of like these godlike figures, that doesn't make them perfect. And and that's a tough thing to have to learn when you've kind of always seen them as being, you know, more of kind of in the state of perfection. And coming to grips with that, I think, and watching him deal with that and then the choices he makes as opposed to the choices, you know, you see somebody like Killmonger make. I just loved that kind of mirroring of those two. And I felt like Chadwick Boseman, he brings this character to life in a way that you really do want to continue watching him. I was rewatching Captain America with my wife, the first one, and Chris Evans does the same thing with Cap. You know, I think Robert Downey Jr. does the same thing with Iron Man. They kind of embody these characters and make them their own, and then they just are those characters. And I feel like, you know, with just the little bit we got with him in Civil War, he had already done that. So coming into this, you know, I already felt like I knew this character. Now there's just even so much more depth.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, if you use, again, those two scenes, you really see just those two scenes are a perfect example of what you were talking about in terms of his journey as a character, his arc, the comparison you were making to Luke Skywalker, and the clarity with which it's delineated in a way which is it's in frame, in camera. You know, it's implicit, not explicit, but still very strong. You have the first scene is set at night. The other one is set during the daytime, this kind of golden hour. The first one, you have T'Challa saying that he's not ready to be without his father, and his father telling him, you have to live. You have to have your own path. The other one is the exact opposite. You have T'Chaka, his father, calling him and saying, come with me, be reunited with me, you know, and then you have T'Challa saying, no, I must correct your wrongs. I can't just abandon my responsibilities. And so I really, you know, you see how the two in a very simple but very strong way are kind of working as this mirror, like you said, which I think then really helps you learn how you can honor the past that you come from, honor your father, honor your heritage, but at the same time, you honor it not just by saying, oh, we're going to stick to dogma, but by saying, okay, this is what's good, and this is where I step in now and add and correct and improve and build upon. I don't just repeat.
Well, and that's something that Shuri says in the film too. I love when she challenges him, you know, just because something works doesn't mean it can't be improved. And
exactly.
I think that's the whole point here, is saying just because things work doesn't mean that it's always best. And that's the, you know, the hard thing that they have to deal with, I think, with Wakanda, is that it feels like a utopia, but it's not. There are still things that could be better, could be done better. And it's, you know, as we see in the film, Chadwick Boseman's T'Challa is struggling with the fact that this, and he's had his eyes open, that it is only a utopia for a very small amount of the world. And holding that to yourself, isn't that wrong to keep others from having that possibility too? And not helping, you know, humankind around the world. So I think that watching him have that struggle, you know, I have deemed many of the Marvel movies in the past, but I feel like next to The Winter Soldier, this is the first Marvel movie that I feel like is really trying to say something. And I love the struggle of T'Challa and Wakanda and they're wrapped up together of what will they choose. And I thought it was just fabulously done. And again, I think it transcends some of the things in the movie that I will ding it for later, because the characters and the thematic elements are elevating it above some of, I would say, the tropes that the movie can't overcome in other areas. This and the characterization is fantastic. And so I love the fact that Lupita Nyong'o is in the film too. And I really liked her as Nakia. Mm-hmm. And I thought she did such a great job of being somebody who challenges T'Challa in a way that he can hear. I thought that mm-hmm. that was really nice to have that love interest be somebody who was there to help open his eyes. And in the end, it's not she that changes, it's he that changes. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, she, you know, she does that to him. She even does that to the character of Okoye, his general. You know, they have that scene where, again, it's a really cool, it's very simple. And it's done in a way that's neither preachy nor dumbed down. Where it reminds me a little bit of the kind of dialogue that Star Trek has, you know, where it will pose an issue and it doesn't even really try to necessarily make you take side. It says, okay, here's one point of view, there's another point of view. Now you think about it and think carefully. And, you know, that scene where the two of them are discussing right after T'Challa has lost his second challenge and they think he's dead. And she says, well, we have to do what we can to right things. And Okoye says, well, but he won the throne legitimately. And they have this little discourse about what's right, you know, the letter of the law, the spirit of the law. And that's also, again, I think that it's a very important topic to pose. And it's also very important to not try to necessarily make people take one side or the other, but it's more important to do what the film does well in that sense, which is to, even if you get the sense that they have their own opinion, to pose it in a way which lets you think about it. Because this is how I think we can come up to the right answers ourselves, as if we are made to think as opposed to fed answers. And I think the movie does that really well. It keeps balancing itself, and that's talking about characters, by also using Killmonger's character. You know, he's, in my opinion, the best villain that Marvel has written so far, because he's someone you empathize with, someone you understand. And more than that, there's a good point counterpoint, like I was talking about with Okoye, where between him and T'Challa, you go back and forth, and it's like a discourse. It's like a conversation saying, well, okay, I see your point of view, but, and the person answering saying, yes, I understand that. However, and up until the very end, and even at the very end, you know, in the last scene, you get the sense that neither of them is really trying to prove the other wrong. And both of them sees, while they don't agree, they see and understand each other's point of view. And I think that's also a very important lesson, especially today, in an age where we tend to try to shout out and shout down people across the table from us, regardless of opinions. They're not trying to do that. They're just saying, well, just consider all the point of views.
I love that you brought that up, because I think it, and it's a good time to, because there's so much tied into the Killmonger character. And he really is kind of at the heart of everything here, because so much of what happens thematically happens through him too. But I loved the way that character taps into so many different things, whether it's the abandonment issues that happen. You know, his whole society abandons him and leaves him for, you know, to whatever will happen. It's pretty awful. But at the same time, too, you get this kid who also sees that happen. He gets radicalized, as they call it, which I loved that term, because radicalization is the taking of pain from the past or the present and turning that into hatred and revenge. And that happens to him. so that all he can see then is the evil that's happened in the world and none of the good. And when you continually feed yourself that, that's where you become an us versus them type of thing. And I love that Killmonger is just, he is so hell-bent on making people pay for what they've done, whether it's happened to him specifically or he's just seen the from the past. And I think what the movie does beautifully, as you were talking about, Nick, is it says, it shows these two different views, and it definitely takes the side of where we get with T'Challa, but it also allows us to experience what happened to Eric. And I think that's an important thing, because part of what happened to him isn't his fault, and part of what happened to him is. And you put those two things together, and they create the problem that we see on a lot of the world, which is this focus on building hatred in people and creating fear in people and creating division in people. And he is the embodiment of everybody who just becomes it's us versus them. And I have to say, you know, Michael B. Jordan just plays it so perfectly. Because there is a sense of deep-seated pain and hurt in his eyes that you see, but then there's that fire of hatred that almost just burns that out. And it's a good representation, I think, of a lot of different places in our world. And sometimes maybe I think I have to remember, I need to look inside my own heart. Is that there somewhere? You know, that's what I like about this character. I have to agree with you. I think in the Marvel films, he is probably at least top three villain-wise, because his villainy is so tied in to every part of this story. He's not tacked on. He's not just, you know, the CGI thing that we have to fight. He's integral to every part of this story. And he's made by so many different people's decisions as well as his own. And one of the things I think is so smart is that they never take away the responsibility of him, but they also never take off the responsibility, say, to T'Challa for the choice that he made. And I love that, because it's so important for us to remember that people aren't just made by one choice. They're made by many, and some of them aren't even their own.
Yeah, I mean, again, I agree with you 100%. And I think, you know, you talked about, you compared T'Challa's journey to Luke Skywalker's. And in many ways, Killmonger's journey reminded me of Anakin Skywalker's journey. And I think that, I don't know that that was intentional. I think that if I had to guess, I would speculate that it's more that both in very smart and in deliberate ways, George and Ryan tapped into some of these universal archetypes about our nature. And you talked about your own heart and the duality that we have in ourselves, and how, like you said, a lot of the bad things that come out of us are very oftentimes caused by things that happen to us, which initially we didn't have any control over. Then there's still the fact that at some point you make the conscious choice to then act in a way which is to then perpetuate or create more wrongness, you know? And so you have, again, this duality of somewhere you were or are a victim, but somewhere you also have the responsibility of then acting in a bad way. And I think that you see that journey that he goes through, again, like Anakin, he's someone who, had he been loved, had he been trusted more, had he not been abandoned, could have been a completely different person. You definitely, in my opinion, I felt like I saw a character who realizes, who sees that deep down inside, that you know, I could have been a good person, but who believes it's too late for me. And I think that the end scene between him and T'Challa really, really reminded me of the end scene between Anakin and Luke, where it feels like T'Challa has redeemed him by showing him love, by doing what no one else has done his whole life. You know, after defeating him, instead of killing him, instead of just arresting him, instead of just putting him away or knocking him out, what does he do? He gives him the wish that he's always had his whole life, to see the sunset on Wakanda. And just this one act of love, when this person didn't have to in any shape or form give it to him, is enough to make him understand and redeem him, which is also why I think he dies and he kills himself. And he says, which is a beautiful line, you know, that I'd rather choose death over bondage. And I think it's a powerful and true line, but I think it's also his way of saying, just like Vader, you've redeemed me, and now the only thing I can do is to die, because this is how we all move on. You know, this is the end of the journey for me. You know, I think that in there's a lot of messages, again, a lot of lessons to learn, and it's done in a way which is, there's a lot of deep ideas, but it's not preachy, and it's still clear and strong for kids and everyone.
I love that he's like, basically, I could have been somebody, Charlie. I could have been a contender. It just reminds me of On the Waterfront with that. But I love that idea too, because the other thing that I think that you see there is, and through the two, you see the difference between somebody who grows up in a place where he knows that he's loved and cared for and nurtured, and the difference of not having that. You know, T'Challa has a fantastic family. He's a wonderful mother and father who love him. He's got a, you know, crazy beautiful sister who's just goofy and super smart, you know, and keeps him in line in many ways. He's surrounded by amazing people that are there to support him. And then we see the other side of, you know, Eric, who has nothing. He has none of that because it's taken away from him. It's not his choice. It's taken away from him. And I think it's the... That's the micro level, but the macro level is the way that Wakanda itself has taken itself away from the world to help the world. And it has fostered this, you know, this beautiful thing unto itself, and yet it's hurting the rest of the world because it's not sharing what it has in wisdom and technology in a way that could truly help the world, maybe have less wars and less hate. And I just think that's really interesting, because there is a part of the movie too where Eric taps in to a restlessness that's happened in Wakanda that's been simmering under the surface. And it comes with Okoye's boyfriend choosing to join sides with him because he's seen in action for too long. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. They tapped into something that people had dismissed as not really being there. And interestingly, you know, this movie is being made 2 years ago, so many of the things we're dealing with now, mm-hmm. were barely on the radar, right, politically. And yet it became prophetic in a lot of ways. And I think that's interesting, because we really get this sense of, like, tapping into this feeling of inaction that leads to anger, that leads to hate, that leads to suffering. And I mean, it becomes, there's so many great Star Wars parallels here. And I feel like you were right. You know, what we're seeing is these archetypes really being played out. And I think that's one of the things that makes this movie so strong in a lot of ways, and why it's resonating with so many people, is because those thematic elements that are timeless, that'll still stand up even when this political regime in the United States and some of the places around the world are gone, it's still going to mean something, because these are timeless themes that we need to be reminded of over and over again.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, like you said, it doesn't matter, you know, sadly, in a way, what regime is standing where colors or flags or nationalities, there's always going to be at some level, small or big, that lesson, because those are universal themes, and it's part of our perpetual effort to grow as a species and as individuals. I think that you connected part of what you were talking about also goes into the second central theme of the film for me, which is unity and the idea, you know, united we stand, divided we fall. I think the child's best friend, you know, Okoye's boyfriend, is a perfect example. And again, they crafted a character who kind of is there to sort of put out one point of view, and they do it in a way which is they're not trying to indict or really, you know, say, okay, here's the side that's wrong and the side that's right. I mean, I think you get the sense, again, the movie's not shying away from implicitly letting you know how it feels, but it's not trying to shove down its opinion in your throat, you know, because the characters are all sensible people, intelligent people. And so rather than say, well, here's the bad guy or the person who's wrong and the good guy, the person who's right, you because you believe all the characters, you also believe their point of view, even if you disagree. You understand why they could be misled or why they could think what they think. And you know, so they do a really good job, I think, at through this character showing you why a person might be led to believe that isolationism might be the better choice, that isolationism, which then leads to, you know, expansionism, might be an even better choice. And I think that doing it in a way which, again, makes you listen and relate, empathize to that character is important, rather than just say, that's a bad guy, this person is wrong. Because then, by listening, is how you can actually have a dialogue and get out of a situation, rather than say, you're wrong, shut up. And you know, that is what successfully leads to the moment where, you know, there's a confrontation, but when it comes to Okoye and him, you know, he lays down his weapons and you know, kind of sees the futility. He looks around and sees what's happening and sees, like you were saying, that in the end, by cutting yourself off, even to be strong, it's a very short-sighted way of thinking, and you hurt yourself more than anything in the long run. And he sees that literally happening around him. The first people to suffer are his people. And that's really what causes him to decide to lay down his weapons.
Well, and I like that so much. I think the strength of this film and the importance of the message of this film, especially for today, and I'm sure that it will continue to be, is it's the film champions we, not us versus them. And this idea that it's so important to have us together, that we are stronger together. And I love what you said, because I think it's so vital, is that he recognizes, as he looks around, he sees that it is his people being hurt first, because he's chosen an us versus them. And when we make it that way, we don't have any recourse but to fight each other, because it becomes binary. We don't listen. We don't think about the complications in life or the ways in which, you know, and one could be partially light but not quite all right. And I think that's the thing about this movie, is that it's not showing us that there are any easy answers. What it's showing us is that the right way to do this is the hardest way. It's to mm-hmm. sit down and listen and find common ground, even when it's really tough. And to not just call names or to hide from each other or to want to burn the world to the ground and start over. You know, it's interesting that... that again, Killmonger reflects Kylo Ren and Luke Skywalker. We'll just burn it all down and we'll start over. You know, and what we see is that T'Challa chooses to take the best of the past, leave the worst of it behind, and create something with that tradition to build something beautiful for the future. to create a new and better version of what we have been, to create Wakanda 2.0. And much like Shuri might do. And I think that's the thing that's so beautiful, is that it also isn't one of race or color or creed or anything like that. It's not about what we look like, you know, because Killmonger keeps talking about people that look like us. But T'Challa never falls into that trap of saying it's only about people that look like us. We need to remember that we are in this together. We're the family of humanity, you know, and we can't just be helping people that look like us. We have to help everybody because, as again, a Star Wars thing, you must realize that you're in a symbiotic relationship. What happens to one will affect the other. And yeah. T'Challa realizes this, I think, and I love that he does, and I think it's the power of this movie. And, you know, what I like, too, is that when you see Wakanda, Wakanda is this kind of utopia. So you understand the struggle of, if we open ourselves up, what is going to happen to what we've created? And I love that for what you see, you can really empathize with the wanting to keep yourself separate, because you are not going to be the same. It is just the reality that if you start to open yourself up, there is going to be change, but it can also be change for the better, not just the worst.
Yeah, and I think that you know, the smart thing about choosing to have this dichotomy at play within a fictional country and a fictional place, it's a very smart choice and a very strong one, because by doing that, it really helps you. Again, it's science fiction and fantasy at its best. It displaces the issue in a way you're not going to immediately consciously think about until after the message has been distilled. And within this fictional community, it starts to create that dynamic of the Earth versus them, as two sides emerge within that world also, right? They talk about the us versus them in terms of Wakandans versus people outside Wakanda. But that in turn creates within Wakanda an Earth versus them dynamic of those who agree with that and those who disagree with that. And that is, you know, the great thing about that model is that within then the fictional world of Wakanda and the Wakandans, they can really teach you the lesson that in the end, there is never an us versus them. There's only us. There's only us, right? You can draw any kind of fictional border through a nationality, a language, a flag, or whatever to invent the idea of an us versus them, but it's always us. And all the characters in their own way through the story come to that realization through the film, which then can lead to, in the epilogue, this beautiful line, you know, wise men build bridges and foolish men build barriers. And that's really, in my opinion, I mean, that's to me, that was the strongest, the most effective and powerful message of the whole film. You know, every character has a journey that leads them, even Killmonger, to realize that. And so that the final message, you know, moral meaning and message of the film is contained in that line. Wise men build bridges, foolish men build barriers.
Well, and I think that the strength, too, is the way that they show Wakanda walking the line between there is going to be a need for protection, but that doesn't mean that we don't reach out. And showing the reality of that, because there are going to be people who choose to make it us versus them, and that means we will have to defend ourselves. And we'll do that vigorously, and not denying that fact, but also not reaching out the hand and at least offering, you know, to come together. And I think, it's the strength of this movie, is it's not denying the realities of the world we live in. It's also just showing us that we can't become slaves to our baser instinct, which is to just make it about us versus them. And it takes more of us as human beings to rise above that basest human instinct to be better than that. And that's what we see happening. And I love that about T'Challa making that choice, you know, and having these people around him who help him make that choice. And, you know, I think coming back around a little bit to some characters, I love T'Challa's sister, Shuri, because I think that she is the one who's most ready to make that change and be out there, you know, because she's younger and, you know, kind of hipper, obviously, than anybody else in the movie. And she's so in touch with, I think, the technology and the ways that she can help people. And of course, we already know that she's been helping one white boy, and she helps another one who's broken. And so, which is a plot hole in and of itself, but we'll just let it go. I just love her, though. I think that the way she's played and the vibrancy that she has, but the way that she challenged, again, her brother there at the beginning, where she says, just because something works doesn't mean it can't be improved. And throughout the entire movie, she is trying to improve things any way she can. And it doesn't matter who they are, what they look like, what color they are. She's willing to give her of herself to help in any way possible. And I think, she is an inspiration in a lot of ways to her brother because of that. And I really, really liked that.
Yeah. She's a fantastic character. You know, and again, they have this wonderful way in the film of addressing issues without ever becoming preachy or judgmental. Like you said, she embraces when there's a lot, almost a throwaway line, you know, when she first greets Agent Ross, Martin Freeman's character, and she calls him a colonizer, right? But she does it as a joke, and it's played very well. It's written well, it's played well and directed well, because it acknowledges a fact, but it also, like you said, it shows how, it gives you a model for how we can acknowledge the truth, but we can also rise above and move on and go beyond. She doesn't stop, she doesn't judge, she doesn't forget, but she's also, you know, her arms are open, and she doesn't prejudge him as an individual. And I think in that little moment is another really strong nugget of a lesson for the importance of acknowledging things and limitations, things that have happened, but also the ability to move forward and not be stuck in the past.
I think one of the things that I love about what she does is she does not allow the past to control who she is or who she'll be. And she's not a slave to it. And I think, again, I think that's, and that word is particular there, I think, isn't so important, because we do so much become, I think, enslaved to what happened in the past to us personally and to what's just happened. And it hurts us, you know. I think, you know, obviously Star Trek 5 talks about this issue big time. You know, do we become just a slave to who we were and to what happened? Or do we find a way to overcome? Which is why I think Kirk says in those moments, I need my pain. They make me who I am. I don't forget what it is, but I allow myself to find ways to overcome what's happened. And and I think you're absolutely right. She, and I think T'Challa and Nakia, are all characters who find ways to overcome what has happened. Now, you know, for them, this isn't something that's happened to them, right? You know, they grew up in Wakanda. It's the coolest place on the planet to grow up on. I mean, seriously. But they also realize that it has happened to others that did look like them. And so, and I'm sure that they're probably the Wakandans who may have gotten stuck in that and forced into that kind of lifestyle just because they happen to be in the wrong place in the wrong time. So I really like that. Again, a movie that doesn't deny the past, but also doesn't want us to get so locked into it that we can't move forward. And I think in a lot of ways, what we see there is kind of the MLK version of how to move forward, right? And mm-hmm. I really like that, again, that kind of idea is what's being championed. And I thought it was interesting to have Martin Freeman's character of Ross back. And I'm wondering, is he going to become the new Coulson of the Marvel Universe, where he just kind of randomly shows up, you know? And because I'm all for it, because he was great.
He was. And again, he was there for comic relief to a certain degree, but they didn't overplay it. It never became too cartoony, too goofy. It was just the right dose of him kind of relieving some of the tension or making things a little more lighthearted at times. It would be great if he becomes kind of like, you know, the Alfred Hitchcock of the Marvel movies, where you just look for him.
Oh, I would love it. I think he was really fun. And like you said, I think it was a smart thing that, I really want to call out, because I think this is really important. This movie allows the humor to be a part of the story and the characters in a way that feels organic instead of forced. And it reminded me, again, much more, we just rewatched Captain America, and that movie was very much the same way, in that the humor came from the situation in the character, not just that we have to hit a punchline every so many seconds. You know, I felt like this one, the characters that were the funniest were the characters who just happened to be like that. And, you know, even Ross, his humor comes more from, one, it's Martin Freeman playing it, and just a look can be funny. But there were other points of it where it wasn't just like, I don't know, it's not just you're going for, it's more like the nervous laugh of like, oh, I'm going to die, and so I say something, you know, like, I don't know. I just really appreciated that, and because for me, a lot of times, the Marvel movies, I think, it has felt like recently that it's just been about how many jokes we can squeeze in instead of making sure the jokes actually are in line with and a part of the story in a way that help the story. And I felt like this movie really did that well, like some of the past Marvel movies that have, like, I think of like Iron Man, the original Iron Man, or, you know, the Captain America film, both one and two, you know, the humor really works in line with everything else that they're doing with the story.
Yeah, I think what you're describing to me, and I definitely felt it, and I agree with you, is playing the straight man humor versus the situation comedy humor. It's what Gene Wilder would describe. You know, I remember an interview with Gene Wilder, and the interviewer asked him, how do you do it? Where do you find it to craft these characters that are so funny? And Gene Wilder responds and says, well, the secret is that my characters don't know they're funny. And so that's what makes them funny, is in their point of view, they're just being themselves. And I think that for me, that's a question of taste. I've always responded to that type of humor more. And I think this film definitely featured more of a return to, in my opinion, what Marvel has done well when they've done that, which is the humor being part of this, of what's happening, but there's no breaking of the fourth wall where the characters and the scene is self-aware that it's being funny. It just plays out to the moment as it is. And then so for that reason, you see it as being funny. Martin Freeman does that for sure. And in my opinion, huge shout out to Andy Serkis. I mean, he is, I've always loved Andy Serkis. And you know, it's like, for me, it's like those, I'm like those sports fans who take pride in having always backed up their team, whether they were popular or not. You know, I've always been a huge fan of Andy Serkis, and always said that, in my opinion, he's a terrific actor. He's an Oscar level, you know, actor. And if any role should really put, in my opinion, just silence anybody who detracts of whether he has, you know, the chops to be a, what they call, you know, a real actor, or not. It's this one, because he does a great job at being, again, a guy who, I mean, you completely believe that he is that person, right? And he is this over the top villain who is funny in a way, kind of like, it reminded me a little bit of Jack Nicholson as the Joker, you know, but he's not trying necessarily to make you laugh. He's not playing it for the joke. It's just the way he is. It's just that particular intensity that he lives that makes him wacky. And like you're saying, you almost have this nervous laughter, but it's very effective. It's very effective in the scene.
I completely agree with you. I mean, he was hands down so good in this role because he's so out there. But that's what the character needed. And he does it in a way that feels organic to the character. As crazy as that is, the over-the-top nuts of Claw feels organic when it's coming from Andy Serkis. And I 100% agree with you that I felt like it was so well done from him. And I was really glad that, you know, he was in the movie and that they gave him just a lot of fun things to do in the film that really allowed him to just be. And allowed him to play with that role in a way that I felt like, you know, made it rise above, you know, and of course he comes to an end in the movie, but I really liked Andy Serkis's portrayal of Claw. I felt like it added a sense of like crazy, zany, maniacal villainy to the movie that wasn't there. It wouldn't be there if he wasn't there. So I really liked that. One of the things that I thought of about the movie as I was watching it, Nick, was this idea of the truth will set you free, because so much of the beginning of the movie is based off a lie, which the lie of Wakanda, one, which of, you know, for the rest of the world, what is Wakanda? But two, specifically, there was the other lie that reminded me a lot of the way that the Dark Knight handled things. And then, of course, leading into The Dark Knight Rises, about the lie of Harvey Dent. And what we get here is really the lie of T'Chaka and who he is and what's happened with his nephew and keeping this secret and trying to keep it safe, but that it almost ends up destroying everything that he loves. And what I really liked about this idea is that, in a lot of ways, the way The Dark Knight Rises handles it is that in the end, the truth can be painful, but it will truly set us free to a better future if we live in the truth instead of in the lie. And that lies always come back to haunt us. You know, that I love the line from The Patriot where he says, "I've long feared my sins would come back to haunt me and the price would be more than I could bear." And that's exactly, again, I think what happens here in this movie. We almost end up in a place where a lie destroys the very thing that you're trying to save with the lie. And I love that this movie shows that it really is only the truth that you can live in and have any sense of peace in your life for good, because you have nothing to hide. And I thought that was really well done in the film.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And I think, you know, I mean, just to show how effective that message is and how universal it is, it reminds me of something very similar. My mom used to tell me when I was a kid, and she used almost in those words, she used to tell me, "There will be times in your life where you lie. It's not, you're not going to be able to always abide by that lesson. But try to remember that there is no lie that doesn't come out one day or another. And so even a lie that is done for the right reasons, quote unquote, for noble reasons, what you think is to protect someone or that makes sense, it will come out. And when it comes out, every lie hurts. And the more time goes by, the more it will hurt and the more it will damage. So even when you lie for what you think or what you tell yourself are good reasons, it will always come out, number one, and it will always cause pain, more pain than the truth. So no matter how afraid you are of telling the truth, no matter how afraid you are of the pain that truth causes sometimes, and it does, always remember that lying in the end causes more pain. And you see that at play. I mean, I think that you see that in a way, and I can't quite articulate it, but for me, it came together in the scene between Killmonger and his father when he is under the effect of the medicine.
Yeah.
And because you see, you have these wonderful reunions between T'Challa and his father, and because of the lie that has completely pervaded both of their lives in the way that they were victimized and then the way that they victimized others, you see the two of them at what should be a moment of really kind of enlightenment for their two spirits being completely unable really to communicate and to find peace. Both of them are crying, and you can tell that they're trying to communicate to each other, but they don't quite reach one another. And it ends, I think what breaks their heart is that they can tell that scene ends without either of them really being able to embrace the other. And to me, that really reminded me of that message that when you live a lie, at the end of the day, no matter how long you live, no matter how prosperous, no matter how much you can kind of polish it with, well, it made sense, or I, you know, it didn't damage me, it didn't hurt me. At the end of the day, inside, that's always what it's going to cause is that sort of like unresolved sadness and pain.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I thought it was so strong in the movie. And again, it's one of those things that was just really well done in the film. And I just love that there are so many things that were, I thought, point on, just spot on for the movie. And now, I did want to talk a little bit, because there are a few things I felt like that the movie didn't do as well. And really, to me, those kind of revolved around a couple of things. As much as I liked the characters and the thematic elements, I did feel like that there were a lot of places where the story was very obvious and a little bit too cliched in some places, and I was never surprised about anything that happened in the film, and that was a little bit frustrating to me, to kind of be able to know exactly what's going to happen pretty much at every moment of the movie. And not be surprised in any story sense, like that they didn't switch up enough of those archetypes or tropes or anything to really allow me to have any kind of like, oh, moment. Like, there wasn't any of that. I have to call out Nick, I think, for a Marvel movie, which we've come to expect to have, you know, great effects and everything. There was some pretty dodgy CGI. I'm calling out you, Rhinos. But there are some other places where I was just like, they spend a lot of money on these movies and it still looks like that, you know? Like, and this doesn't even have the Justice League excuse of having half your movie reshot.
Which, by the way, you know, I didn't have a problem. Like, the Justice League, I don't know, that's this whole other discussion, I guess, but I didn't have a problem at all with... I think it was hurt by a lot of this kind of preconceived, you know, biases against DC. If anything, like you said, it to me, it's a sign that there's not really a type of effect that's better, or, you know, Marvel does it better than DC or DC. You know, I thought Justice League was a great story, a great film, and you know, there were some moments that had effects that didn't work for me, but it never hurt the film. And I think that I had the same going on for this one. I was never taken out of the story. I felt like, and this supports the theory that I've always had, or kind of the argument that I've always had, that at the end of the day, if you focus on telling the right story, in the moment, in the scene, in the whole picture, and even if you break it down to the level of the shot as an effect shot, you know, Jaws is the perfect example. If your shot tells the right story, you're fine. It doesn't matter how shoddy your matte lines are or your animation, if it has too much motion blur, if the moment is right, if the choice of shot, of camera angle, if the action of what's happening tells you the right story, the viewer will fill in the blanks because the viewer will want to believe it. Now I will say, you know, I do agree with what you said in terms of the sort of like the tropes, kind of the beats, the predictability of it. I don't necessarily, it's hard for me to tell, right? Because I worked on the film. So I knew 95% of the film going in. So it's really hard for me to tell how much of that comes from knowing the film or structural problem or not with the film. But I would say again, and with that caveat, if anything, if I was going to be critical of anything, it wouldn't even be necessarily for this film in particular. I think for me, it signals to me, and I've had this conversation with a couple of other people, I think I may be getting to a point where I'm a little saturated with a particular type of superhero film. And so that model, you know, I feel like I might be getting in 2018 where people were getting at the end of the 70s or early 80s with the end of the Western genre, where it was like, okay, yeah, we get it. We've seen that. We know what's going to happen. There's the big cattle owners and the loner who wanders into town, and we're going to have this scene and that scene, and it's going to end with a high noon duel. And so, you know, that model is starting to kind of feel to me like, unless you are really letting it grow and pushing it beyond that, I'm going to be less interested. But again, that's not necessarily the movies themselves individually being at fault. It's kind of the genre sort of, you know, having to tell us, in my opinion, whether it's able to grow beyond itself or not. You know, I feel like Logan, for example, is one movie that didn't yes. fall into that and actually used the model and went beyond it. So I'm kind of challenging other superhero films, and I don't care whether they're Marvel, DC, or any, you know, for many, it doesn't matter. It's not about that. To sort of, if they're going to stay within that playpen, you got to start playing with the toys differently.
You know, I think that's a really good state. I really like what you're saying, because I was talking with another friend of mine, and I'll keep him anonymous. But the idea of, he asked me, and I thought this was a great question, can you spoil a Marvel film anymore? Because I do feel like there is, and I think this is not just a Black Panther thing, but I think there's kind of an overarching way in which all the movies happen, you know, and you know what the beats are going to be, and they're going to hit them, and there isn't anything truly revolutionary, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, right, that there's kind of a routine. But I do think you're absolutely right in the sense of, like, calling out the Western. Like, you got to that point where people are just kind of, like, done with the genre, and we have had such an oversaturation of the formula, I think, that we do have to be really careful, and that's one of the things, obviously, Star Wars is having to go through right now to figure that out, and a lot of places are having to do that. But finding something fresh, bringing something unique to the genre is really important. And again, this is the great thing, I think, about Black Panther, is that the way that it did overcome that is it gave us compelling characters and it gave us resonant themes that cover over a multitude of sins in the movie. And I think that's the most important thing that I take away from this. And again, I think it's one of the most important things about this type of genre. Like you said, you need to be able to find a way to cover those things over. If you're going to use them, make sure that your characters are spot on. Make sure that your themes are deep and give somebody something to think about. So it's not just, oh, well, that was the popcorn action flick, and I've seen it before, and there wasn't anything all that exciting. You know, this is able to overcome that. But I do think that beyond the significance of this film's, you know, main character and where it takes place, the actual execution of the story and everything wasn't something that was revolutionary. There were other things about the movie that were revolutionary, but the film itself isn't. And I don't know if other movies would be able to get away with it if they didn't have some of those other things. And that's what kind of, I think, sadly, we live in a hyperbolic world where everything is either the greatest thing ever or the worst thing ever. And in the end, I do think that on a whole, Black Panther becomes something that's greater than average, obviously. And I really enjoyed, and I'll be honest, it's definitely, I have a ranking of Marvel films and it's in my top eight. So, I mean, that's pretty good out of 18 films.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you. It's not a cop-out for me. It's hard for me to tell because I felt the same things you described, but it was almost like kind of like, you know, having the roof of your mouth burnt from having had pizza that was too hot, and then the next day you're eating something and you can't quite tell whether it has no taste or whether it's you can't taste it because your roof of your mouth is burnt. And so knowing the film inside out, having worked on it for 10 months, I couldn't tell whether the times when I wasn't engaged because I knew what was going to happen was something that was an issue with the film itself or just me, because I just knew the film having worked on these scenes over and over and over and over and over, right? If I was to draw any comparison, I think where I really kind of feel exactly what you're describing is when I saw Wonder Woman. I did not think, I mean, it's almost word for word what you said. I did not think that it was a movie that was extremely well executed, strictly speaking from the filmmaking standpoint. But I loved the movie for what it did. I loved the movie for what it stood for. I loved what it achieved. And I loved the way it was embraced, and I believed that it deserved to be embraced the way it was. And so, like you said, it was a conscious choice, but I was completely willing to give it a pass and forgive. I don't even know if I would go so far as to call it sins, but its flaws, because I felt like it rose beyond that and did something that was relevant and important and good enough that those flaws didn't matter or mattered so little that it was not worth really wasting time on, you know?
Yeah, I think that too, part of it as well, and one of the things I want to compare it with Wonder Woman, because I think that's a great thing as you're kind of wrapping up. One of the things that this movie does is it takes its mythology seriously, which is something some of the other Marvel films haven't done. They didn't with Thor. They made him not a god, and then they kind of backtracked a little bit with Thor Ragnarok and kind of moving them back in more of that god status. Here, they fully embrace the mythology of the Black Panther with the Panther goddess Bast and the creation of Wakanda. And I think that's truly important because you're creating a movie that has earnestness to it, saying, no, we embrace this. We embrace it as the reality for these characters in this world. And that is awesome. And that's what Wonder Woman, I think, did so well, is that it just embraced full on the mythology. And so it allowed you to feel the weight of the world and the reality of it, because they had a full on appreciation and no apologies were made for what was happening in the film or where it came from or anything like that. And I think Wonder Woman and Black Panther both have that strength by just embracing the mythology that they are created from. And that helps us as a viewer then just embrace that world along with the characters and along with the story. And I think both of these films had a earnestness about them in that. They internally take themselves seriously. There's fun, yes, in the movies, but they take themselves seriously. And I think that's the thing that we as an audience really do respond to.
Exactly. I mean, like you said, you know, the way you ended is perfect when you said they take themselves seriously and in the most complimentary way. When you are dealing with subject matter, a world that is so on the edge of being unbelievable in terms of what it is visually, conceptually, I think the only way you can really treat it, execute it, is if you have to go again. It's what we were talking about for the comedy of the straight man. You have to put yourself in an environment where in the scene to you it's just a normal world. And you're not trying to cover up the fact that it's a completely over the top fantasy, you know. For you, that's just the world as it is, and we don't question it because we've never known anything else. And you know, it's going back a little bit to Star Trek as a comparison. That's Star Trek is at its best. You know, when you have a guy in front of Kirk who has black makeup on half his face and white makeup on half his face. And it looks ridiculous from a realistic scientific standpoint. But when the characters, when everyone in the scene embraces what it is, takes it seriously, as in like, this is what it means. And we don't question ourselves. We're not trying to convince you of what it is because we believe what it is. You completely embrace it and you don't question it because you get what they're trying to do. When it tries to do the opposite, which is to get ahead of it by coming up with techno babble and, you know, justifications left and right, is when it falls apart, because they're telling you, they're signaling, yeah, we know it's bogus and we're just trying to make up for it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think we could probably talk more about the film, but we should probably wrap it up. And I wanted to ask you, so maybe out of 10, how do you think you'd rate Black Panther?
I think if I didn't know the movie going in, it's hard for me to try to guess. But if I have to guess, if I was just coming at it fresh, I would probably give it an 8.5 on a scale of 1 to 10. Knowing it through and through, and so having that kind of giving me again this sort of not numbness to it, but it does remove me a little bit of the engagement that I could have otherwise. It dings it, but I'm hard pressed to tell that that's the movie's fault, because it's not. But it, I guess, knocks it back down to probably, I would say, if I can get really particular, a 7.75 claws out of 10.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I'm going to, you know, cannon hands.
That's right.
You know, I, like I said, you know, the story and the strength of the themes, it's not the story, but it's the strength of the themes and the characters and the cast, I think, that keep this from being a mediocre movie. And that's awesome, you know. And I think I'm trying to be very consistent, because it's definitely one of the things that I really dinged some of the other Marvel movies for, is being kind of predictable, being too humorous, and not feeling like they really have anything to say. This movie doesn't do that. This movie definitely has a point. It takes itself seriously. It takes its world seriously. And it takes us seriously by trying to help us see the future can be better if we will come together. And I like that. I really do. That's the kind of thing I want from these type of movies, you know, kind of the thing that George Lucas always said was what Star Wars was for, which is to teach us something. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, comics have always been like that, too, when they've been written really well. And so for me, you know, this is easily 7.5 out of 10. Panther necklaces. So I have a hard time choosing which one. So
yeah, I don't think I'd go for the gold one either. I would be like T'Challa. That's a little too much.
Yeah, I don't really do the bling well. That's just not me. My wife will tell you know, I don't wear jewelry really, and even my wedding ring is very you know, understated, just because it's just not me. So yeah, I'm right there with you. But hey, Nick, I loved having you on the show, and really appreciate you being here. But I want to thank our associate producers here through Patreon. Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson for making sure that this show, the 602 Club, and every other show on the network keep coming to you each and every week. Really appreciate those guys and their dedication to that. Now, Track FM is a huge network, and there's really no way for us to make this happen without you. Patreon.com/TrackFM is the place to go, and it allows listeners from all over the world to be able to support this network and make sure that all the content on Track FM keeps coming to you each and every week. And it's just too big of an enterprise to have happen just from the hosts. So again, you can go over to patreon.com/trekfm. Every little bit helps each and every month. And we have many different ways that we like to give back to you, whether it's early access to content, producer credits, sitting on the Patreon's roundtable, and more. So again, go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of our team. Now, Nick, again, so cool to have you here. I love having you back on the show. Let everybody know where they can find you if they wanted to talk, you know, maybe some more Black Panther or what else maybe you've got going on.
Sure. Well, thanks. First, thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure, and it's an honor to be back. And I just want to say, you know, to anybody listening out there, if you want to be part of a community of people who share the same things you like, who are always inclusive, who are respectful at the same time as they, you know, have different opinions, it's really worth taking the time to become a patron of the network of Trek FM. I am one, and, you know, I've been one for, I think, a year and a half now. And it's a great community. And like you said, there's tons of stuff. You really feel like you're not just donating, you actually become part. You get a lot in return. So really, really worth it. For anybody who wants to be in touch, I'm not too much on social media. I'm kind of taking a sort of a semi break, which is really, really feeling awesome. I love it, loving it. But I am on Facebook every now and then, so people can look me up just by my name. I would say a good 2/3 of the Facebook presence I have is on the Babel Conference, which is Trek FM's community in Facebook community page. And so they can find me, you know, not as much as I used to be, you know, because again, I'm kind of sort of doing a Facebook and social media cleansing a little bit, but I'm still there. I'll still pipe in and make a comment here and there. And those will probably be the, I'm not on Twitter. So those would be the two best ways to find me online.
Awesome, man. And you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02, as well as on Instagram under the same name. You can also find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones, talking about Deep Space Nine. We hope to be back soon for everyone. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network talking Owlpost with Drea Kaufman as we were walking through each and every chapter of the Harry Potter series. Now, we've just started the Goblet of Fire, so make sure you check that out. It's been a lot of fun. I am doing with my esteemed co-host John Mills, Aggressive Negotiation, as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. We dive into a little corner of the Star Wars galaxy and just talk about it, whether it's a wacky question or diving into, you know, one of the arcs of the Clone Wars, talking about a movie, music. I mean, we cover it all, so hope you'll check that out. And then last but not least, doing a show with my friend Courtney called Cinema Stories, and that's where we kind of talk about the morals, meanings, and messages of films through the lens of faith. So I hope you'll check all of those out. You can find them wherever you get your podcasts. But thank
and speaking of aggressive negotiations, sorry Matt, I'm just cutting you off for a second. Shout out to Jedi Master John Mills, to anyone listening, not just an amazing Star Wars podcast, not just probably, I mean, to me, the best Star Wars podcast there is out there, but also an award-winning Star Wars podcast. I'm going to say it because otherwise this guy's going to be too humble to say it himself.
Well, thank you.
There you go.
We did win a Parsec Award, so and it was super exciting. We're very honored, humbled, and I would say proud that did happen. So, yes, and I hope everybody will join us there. It really is. John and I, we've become the best of friends, and I think it's what helps make the show great, is because we just like hanging out, talking Star Wars together. So, but thank you so much for joining us on the 602 Club. And y'all come back now, you hear?